In the first video in the series, called Payload, we explored how the so-called vaccine was intended to work. In this video, we are going to take a deeper look into the technology behind it, and especially that of nanocapsules. One commonly asked question is why do some people get sick and even die, while most are quite healthy, with no outward signs that anything is wrong? Surely, if they were injected with the same thing, they should have a similar outcome, but that is clearly not the case. What could explain such a marked difference in results? Another strange phenomenon we are seeing is presenters and live stage performers collapsing while using wireless microphones and in-ear monitors.
I'm not feeling very well right now, and I'm about to...
Okay, well, come back to me right now.
What could possibly be causing this? And why are people suddenly dropping dead when they are in the presence of strong electromagnetic radiation, like waiting at an electric vehicle charging station? And if the vaccines contain such toxic elements, why wouldn't everyone drop dead as soon as the needle went in? The answer to all these questions and more is nanocapsules. A nanocapsule is a nano-sized shell made from a non-toxic polymer membrane, which encapsulates an inner liquid core known as the payload. Drugs or toxins can be placed inside the core of the nanocapsule. In drug delivery, nanocapsules provide a shielding environment, protecting the cargo against biological and chemical degradation. Normally, there will be a trigger mechanism designed into the system so that the payload can be released at the target location. Applications for nanocapsules are widespread across many industries, from electronics to drug delivery. Analysis of the vaccines at the nanoscale using electron microscopy in the 50 to 100,000 times magnification range shows that they appear to contain carbon-coated nanocapsules. Nanocapsules is an emerging technology. The capsules themselves are hollow, with the outer shell protecting an inner content. So how are nanocapsules made, and how is it possible to fill them with drugs or toxins? The first thing to understand is that they are incredibly small. How small? Well, if you took a millimeter, or 3/64 of an inch, and divided that into 1 million slices, that's how small it is. They cannot be seen by eye, or even by using a medical microscope. They can, in fact, only be seen using an electron microscope. Electron microscopy is a technique that is used to image materials that are smaller than visible light, and thus cannot be seen on a conventional optical microscope. There are two main types of electron microscope. The first is transmission electron, and the second is the scanning electron microscope. With TEM, one side has an electron beam and the other side has a detector. In between is the sample, which is dried down onto a grid. Nanoparticles absorb the incoming electrons, which creates shadows where the particles are. From this data, we can learn about the particle size, structure, shape, and even crystallinity. If we also know the concentration of the particles, we can combine the numbers to calculate things such as surface area and particle concentration. In this case, we are using the second type, called the scanning electron microscope. This scans the surface with a focused beam of electrons. The electrons interact with atoms in the sample, producing surface topography and composition of the sample. However, neither of these two types of electron microscope can tell us what the payload contents are inside the nanospheres. There are many different types of nanocapsules. These include polymeric, Mitchell's, dendrimers, and carbon nanotubes. In drug delivery, one of the most commonly used types is the polymeric. And while nanotechnology itself may sound complex, making nanocapsules can be as simple as mixing the ingredients together, then using ultrasonic equipment to agitate the mix, thus creating even-sized nano droplets, and then adding ingredients to allow the cross-linking bonds to form the core shell around the target drug. Given the nature of the potentially lethal contents in these injections, a more robust type of nanocapsule technology would have been required. Analysis of the materials found in the vaccines shows that they are made of carbon and oxygen, which rules them out being some kind of electronic device. It does, however, fit perfectly with what's known as carbon-coated nanoparticles, also known as PCCMs. But what other elements were found that can indicate what these nanocapsules are made from? We get a clue for this from elements shown in the spectrum analysis. Looking at a nanocapsule that was not fully formed, we can see that silicon is present in high quantities. The silicon and the carbon shown on the surface of fully formed ones indicates that the most likely candidate is the hollow core silicon shell carbon-coated nanocapsule. What are these and how are they made? The process starts off with a template made of silicon dioxide, an oxide of silicon, with the chemical formula SiO2, most commonly found in nature as quartz. Then the sphere is coated in a fiber called polyacrylonitrile, also known as PAN, using a polymerization process. The coating involves dipping the sphere into a solution of PAN monomers, followed by polymerization to form the PAN fiber coating. The purpose of PAN, as a carbon-containing polymer, is to use it as a source of carbon. This is achieved by heating it to 900 C for 3 hours in the presence of nitrogen, causing the PAN to carbonize and form a carbon layer around the nanocapsule. The sample is then homogeneously mixed with magnesium powder to create pores in the carbon shell. This step is important to create the hollow core shell structure later. The mixture is annealed at a high temperature of between 650 and 800 C for 2 hours to facilitate the formation of pores in the carbon shell. After cooling, the sample is stirred in a hydrochloric acid solution to remove the magnesia and create a porous structure in the carbon shell. To create the hollow core center of the nanocapsule itself, the silicon dioxide inside is then removed using a hydrofluoric acid solution. Now the resulting nanocapsules are ready to be loaded to a high capacity with toxins. This process is facilitated by an electrostatic attraction between the nanocapsule and the toxins, due to different voltage potentials. The final step is to give them a bio-stealthy coating like PEG, in order to prevent the body from recognizing and rejecting them. Throughout the payload series, we have referred to these as nanocapsules. This is because it's a better descriptive of what their function is, namely that they encapsulate drugs or toxins. However, the industry in general refers to these as nanoparticles, and most of the literature calls them that. Is this what Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla is referring to here?
Dr. Albert Bourla, a trained veterinarian, but of course the CEO of Pfizer.
What are going to be the key factors that between in the public-private partnerships that we need to have for the future? What are the areas where we need to focus our efforts to have the right kinds of public and private sector engagement?
There was not a single country that they had full sovereignty, as you said it, in the manufacturing, because although we're doing in the beginning in Europe or in the US, the components were made all over the world, and they were unique. There were pieces that we had to import from Europe to the US, from UK to Europe, from multiple, from China, from India, from all over the world, that if any of them was closing as a retaliation, you are not allowing me to export vaccine, I'm not allowing you to receive nanoparticles.
According to this stunning admission by Bourla, nanoparticles were a key component of the vaccine. It's also likely that Bourla is referring to China, because it's one of the few countries that has the capability to scale the production of nanocapsules, and also has a vaccine industry that sold the product into many countries.
A second booster in order to return the performance of the vaccines to where they were after the first booster.
And since when was it necessary to have a second, third, fourth, or even eighth shot of something biological? Or is it not more about returning the level of nanocapsules in the body to their original limits, seeing as the reticuloendothelial system can slowly rid itself of these foreign bodies? Even though that's likely to be a lengthy process, given that each injection contains tens of thousands of nanocapsules. And why are people suddenly dropping dead when using their phones, especially inside metal structures? It would appear that there may be an electromagnetic component or trigger to these nanocapsules. But is that even possible? Does such a thing even exist? Well, a search through research literature does indeed find such a technology, and that it has been tested and proven to work. So what exactly is it, and how does it operate? In cancer drug delivery, it's desirable to be able to target drugs directly to the tumor without affecting healthy tissue. But in order to do that, the nanocapsules need a guidance and trigger mechanism to get them to the target cells, and then promote cargo discharge. We know that nanocapsules are porous and can easily absorb treatment drugs like doxorubicin. But what stops them from leaking their payload? The answer to that is a molecule called rotaxane, which blocks the pores, preventing premature escape of the cargo. Rotaxane resembles the shape of a dumbbell, with a ring trapped in between the two ends. As such, it provides the action of a stopper. Invented in the early 90s by Sir Fraser Stoddart, rotaxanes are unique supramolecular structures in which a cyclic molecule is threaded onto an axle and end-capped by bulky groups at the terminal of the axle molecule. Along with chemists Jean-Pierre Sauvage and Bernard Feringa, Sir Fraser Stoddart was awarded the 2016 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on rotaxanes. If the hollow core silicon shell of the nanocapsule that we discussed before is further modified by zinc doping it with superparametric iron oxide nanocrystals, called spions, and if it has been fitted with rotaxanes, then upon application of an AC magnetic field, the iron oxide nanocrystals generate local internal heating. This causes the molecular machines, the rotaxanes, to disassemble and allows the payload toxins to be released. Paramagnetic materials tend to get weakly magnetized in the direction of the magnetizing field when placed within a magnetic field. Is this why there have been thousands of reports of powerful magnets sticking to people's arms in the area where they were injected? And could this be why there are thermal images showing unusually warm areas in the bodies of the vaccinated?
Then logistical challenges. These vaccines had to be transferred in minus 70 degrees. We have never built in the world a logistical channel to be able to do something like that. And that can go on and on.
Vaccines are supposed to be kept quite cold, correct?
That's correct. And okay, with the Pfizer and Moderna ones, what's unusual is that the refrigeration temperatures are supposed to be minus 40, in the minus 40s for the Modernas, and I think in the minus 70s for the Pfizer. And that's very, very unusual because no biologic reaction requires anything more than minus 20 to be completely frozen in time. So, you know, if there's a biologic specimen that has biologic activity, you rarely see ever any temperature for refrigeration less than minus 20. Then, which brings us to, well, what kind of chemical reactions require extreme cold in order to be halted, right? And so we're looking at free radical reactions, we're looking at polymerization reactions, we're looking at pretty advanced chemistry here, not the type of chemistry you can do in a regular chemistry lab. We're talking advanced chemistry that requires super cold temperatures. So again, that was the first very big warning sign that there is something very wrong with these injections called vaccines for COVID-19. the refrigeration temperature does not make any sense.
Okay.
We know that the toxic payload can be released when the temperature of the nanocapsule is raised by applying electromagnetic radiation. Is this why they have to be stored at such low temperatures, to ensure that any rise in temperature would be maintained way below the level at which a premature release might take place? And perhaps at the extremely low temperature of minus 70 centigrade, like any piece of machinery, everything, including the stoppers, gets frozen firmly in place. But what happens when it doesn't? And what happens when the last procedure in the manufacturing chain, namely the purification phase, goes wrong, leaving raw unencapsulated toxins in the vaccine?
Oh, if I can help falling in love with you.
There's a good reason to wait 15 minutes, because you or your kids are an integral part of the quality control. We could call it the last step. Deaths under 3 hours, known as the parking lot deaths. This chart from the VARS system showing us the massive spike in the reported deaths. We see this huge spike in the days right after the shot, far surpassing all the other data points. It shows us the giant peak in the first half day, the first full day, and the second, third, and fourth day, and then it significantly tapers off. Interestingly though, we have another lump here at about 6 months in. But what happens if only a few of the nanocapsules start to fail?
Headache, chills, swelling, those are some of the side effects that some people experience after getting their COVID vaccine. But what about this one? Vivid dreams. More and more people are reporting they had crazy dreams after getting their shot.
I was on the Titanic. You wake up and you're like, what was that?
He posted his experience on social media and was surprised at the response.
The nightmares and terrible vivid dreams they are seeing are likely due to damage to the delicate glands, like the pituitary and pineal, which produce essential hormones that regulate sleep, like growth hormone, melatonin, and the hallucinogen, DMT. Some slight bursting of the toxin-containing nanocapsules and subsequent release are damaging these very sensitive glands. A lack of growth hormone could also be why they appear to age so quickly.
Got my COVID booster shot. My 5G is not working as good as it was promised.
Hi. So I went to the doctor this afternoon and they did an EKG and immediately sent me to the ER.
Rashes, sometimes very nasty ones, are also a common symptom of the so-called vaccine. But what toxins inside the nanocapsules can possibly be causing all the symptoms we are seeing, like strokes, heart attacks, neurological problems, and a whole host of other diseases?
Snake venoms evolved to immobilize and kill the food that they eat. And so snake venoms are destructive on a whole host of different levels. So you've got blood chemistry problems, you've got neurological issues happening, you've got cardiac issues happening, a depolarization of the muscle cells in your heart. You've got maybe all of these things, nephrotoxicity, myotoxicity, cytotoxicity, cardiotoxicity, neurotoxicity. A snake bite can be a very dangerous event. In fact, it can be a lethal event. And on a cellular level, it's catastrophic. It's nothing to be fooled with or taken lightly. There's no question about that.
So what we're gonna do is pull blood from each one of these vials, and I'm gonna make a little streak, just like that, on the top of this plexiglass board. We're gonna see what happens. Does it run down? Does it turn into jelly? We don't know, right?
Okay. It'll be interesting.
I guess we'll see.
Okay, here we go. Oh, wow, look at that. It's just dripping right out of the, I'm not even applying any pressure yet. And look at that. It's just dripping right out of the syringe. Whoa. Whoa, look at that.
Boy, it's certainly the naked eye. It looks like it's less coagulation going on there, right? I mean, that just ran down.
So here we go. I've got the Eastern Diamondback venom in my blood there. Here we go. 1, 2, 3. Oh, there is a little bit of coagulation there. Wow, look at that.
Some significant clotting. And remember, on this one, Coyote, Eastern Diamondback venom, we think there are both anticoagulant and procoagulant activity happening. But that's interesting.
Research has shown that the blood of the vaccinated contains levels of phospholipase PLA2, which is an inflammatory marker, also found in envenomated patients. Venoms can cause heart depolarization, and with the electromagnetic forces required to pump the blood disabled, this can cause permanent damage to the heart and possibly heart failure. But why are vaccinated athletes more susceptible to cardiac arrest than normal people? It's now known that the amount of work needed to pump the blood around the human circulatory system far exceeds the work done by the heart contracting the left ventricle alone. If the blood vessels in a person were laid out end to end, they would stretch some 105,000 kilometers, more than twice round the Earth. While the power of the heart is just a small 1 to 2 watts, that's equivalent to a tiny pump that would fit in the palm of the hand. As any DIYer would know, 1 to 2 watts would be barely enough power to pump water a few meters, let alone 2.5 times round the world. How can this possibly work? It's now been proven that the additional energy in the blood flow is formed by electromagnetic forces. The force arises from the heart acting as a rotating magnetic dipole. The electric impulse from the heart initiates an oscillating electric field around the red blood cells, and an emerging repulsing electromagnetic force promotes the blood flow. Because red blood cells contain ferromagnetic iron and ferroelectric chloride, they can be viewed as toroidal, electromagnetic field-driven cells. The modulated ECG signal also initiates viscoelastic changes in the blood, aligning the red blood cells into the plane of flow as the flow begins or restarts. It seems strange that doctors have taken 400 years, since William Harvey published his book on the heart in 1628, to start to figure this out. Aside from using physics to calculate the power of the human heart, the medical establishment might have also wondered why there were so many electrically conductive bundles of fibers, like motor windings, placed around the heart. No surprises, then, that it's taken them so long to wake up to the vaccine. Coming back to the original question, though, as to why athletes suffer more cardiac arrests and sudden deaths than the rest of the population. They have more red blood cells than a normal person, and when exerting themselves, there is a lot more cardiac activity going on. Repulsing electromagnetic forces acting on the red blood cells perform the extra work needed to align red cells into the plane of flow as the flow begins or restarts and forms transversal pressure waves. As the heart muscles contract, the electromagnetic repulse force breaks the wall tension and facilitates propelling the blood out of the chambers in the large arteries. Nanocapsules in blood circulation are foreign bodies that do not have this natural alignment propulsion mechanism. They will be subject to complex flow conditions such as stasis, turbulence, and shear that are likely inducing stresses into them. Nanocapsules are generally prone to buckling, caused by shearing, vibrations, or mechanical forces. Such activation is based on the principle that its thin walls render them sensitive to bending and rupture under compressive stress. It's also been reported that body impacts and small injuries, usually picked up during sports activities, have caused vaccine injuries at the same location.
Jesse had an accident on the treadmill and sprained his ankle, and what they thought was a minor injury days later proved to be something very different.
His leg was covered in like a reddish purpley splotchiness, festered in his ankle because that is the weak spot from where he sprained his ankle. And then it just continued throughout his body. Once it got into his bloodstream, his organs started shutting down.
Again, this could be the delicate nanocapsules residing within the body, breaking open under mechanical stress. Independent research into the safety of nanocapsules within the body has shown that they can cause deformation to occur to the shape of red blood cells and clumping known as rouleau. Similar findings have also been found in the blood of the vaccinated. This is one reason why nanocapsules have not been more widely adopted in the drug marketplace. Another strange phenomenon that has been observed is people collapsing in railway stations and in trains around the world. We know that the nanocapsule's release mechanism is likely triggered by electromagnetic radiation. When the paramagnetic nanocapsules are being subjected to a changing magnetic field, measured in Gauss, the interaction of the material's magnetic properties with the alternating magnetic field causes local heating and subsequent release of the payload. In experiments, an alternating magnetic field with a strength of 180 Gauss and a frequency of between 200 and 500 kHz was applied for up to 90 minutes, which resulted in the nanocapsules releasing the red-colored treatment drug doxorubicin into the surrounding liquid. This was laboratory conditions. In the real world, much lower values of field strength and time could work just as well. In live entertainment, vocalists use wireless microphones and in-ear monitors that operate over the 450 to 700 megahertz bandwidth.
Today's the big day. It's going to be crazy.
These wireless transceivers also appear to carry the risk of triggering a payload release.
What's going on, everyone? It's your boy Costa Tage. Listen up.
Iconic guitarist collapsed on stage about an hour into his show.
Has collapsed while on concert.
Loaf reportedly collapsed on stage.
Taken to hospital after collapsing on stage while performing.
Stopped breathing as medical team worked to revive the singer, but ultimately.
It seems that the actual frequency isn't important. It could be that 5G is being used only because of its unique ability to beamform and directly target an individual. Though it may not always be pinpoint accurate. We see lots of examples of people collapsing in or near railway trains. A Taiwanese study has shown that the floors of certain high-speed and intercity trains are emitting potentially harmful levels of electromagnetic radiation during acceleration. The problem is being caused by the traction motors and power supply systems. All modern trains are driven by electric motors, mounted on the wheel axis and driving the wheels directly via gears. This is regardless of whether they are diesel electric or an all-electric design. Traction motors mounted on each axle produce low-frequency magnetic fields. In close proximity, these can be in the order of several Gauss. Additionally, trains have large power transformers or generators and other equipment such as rectifiers and inverters. The EMF produced by a train can take the form of time-varying magnetic fields and electrical fields. These will be strongest when standing on the platform next to where the train pulls in. In many videos, we can see a different person collapsing at a similar location near the platform's edge.
我转天给你留下来。哦，我副座当时听我不演的可以。
年轻的来了。
好。看见你了吗？
你肯定是以那个抽搐肯定是癫痫。
There has even been research conducted into factors of cardiovascular risk for locomotive drivers.
So, someone train driver just dropped to the floor. We're in Houston now, and he literally just fell to the floor. And I can guarantee you, he had the vaccine. Watch it.
And what about the cancer explosion? All these wildfire cancers. And reoccurring cancers that we hear about. What could possibly be causing those?
A small percentage of the new cancer diagnoses would unfortunately be stage four at first diagnosis. But in my practice now, it's approximately two-thirds of all cancer diagnoses since the vax rollout are stage four. And so, you know, pathologists around the world have noticed this, that unfortunately now the people who had previous cancers which were in remission are flaring up since their shots because of the damage to their immune system by the COVID shots. But new cancers being diagnosed, the tumors are bigger than ever. They seem to grow very aggressively, spread very aggressively, and be very resistant to treatment.
And I have started to notice that several of my patients with melanoma who've been stable, stage four disease, they've had very good immunotherapy or other treatments, and I've been reviewing them from 5 to 20 years. I've noticed that I have now over 6, possibly 7, even an 8th yesterday, who've clearly relapsed following the booster vaccine.
One very interesting case was that of Professor Michel Goldman, one of Europe's leading figures in immunology research. As a chief editor at the Journal of Frontiers in Medicine, he wrote up a case study on himself called Rapid Progression of T-Cell Lymphoma Following Pfizer's Vaccine Booster Shot. In the first full-body CT scan he received, we can see those black dots, which is cancer. He realized that he would need to start chemotherapy, so he decided to get a vaccine booster first. Then he undertook another CT scan, and horrifically, it can be seen that within less than a month, cancer has spread throughout a greater part of his upper body. Again, all of those black dots are cancer that the CT scan is picking up. There are also anecdotal reports of nosebleeds, hair falling out, and even teeth breaking and dropping out after vaccination. A weakened immune system and greater likelihood of infection is also common. This is caused by stem cells in the bone marrow being killed off. What could possibly be causing all these symptoms? Aside from all this, which we will get back to, we get a clue from the work of Dr. Daniel Nagasi. In electron microscope analysis of the Pfizer sample, we find a strange fiber-like structure, which is composed of an element called thulium, periodic table name TM. It's from the lanthanide series. Thulium has the distinction of being known as the rarest of rare earth metals. It's soft and can be cut with a knife. It's also relatively expensive. It has absolutely no business being in a vaccine. But one of the more interesting isotopes of thulium is TM-170. It ejects soft gamma radiation as it decays, producing soft X-rays. These X-rays are typically of low energy and are used in medical imaging and other applications that do not require the higher energy levels of hard X-rays. It is used in compact sources of exterior radiation, which are used for obtaining dental images and in search of micro cracks in welds and pipes. The miniature thulium devices are suitable for X-ray diagnostics in the tissues and organs that are difficult and sometimes impossible to scan with conventional X-ray machines. The symptoms we listed before all appear to be those identical to that of radiation poisoning. So we would be looking for a causal element that was likely radioactive. Cesium-137 has been mentioned, but with a long half-life of 30 years, it would be easily detectable. They could be digging bodies up in 30 years' time and still finding it. Thulium has the benefit of having a short half-life of only 128 days, meaning it's quite short-lived. It would be spent and undetectable after a year or so. We don't know for sure which isotope of thulium was detected, but it does fit the profile we are looking for, perfectly. And is that why people who are around the newly vaccinated often report feeling that they are radiating something? In one instance, an unvaccinated hairdresser reports having a pouring nosebleed after cutting the hair of a vaccinated woman.
It just pours and pours and pours. Oh, I need to know what to do. Give me the towel, please.
Others reported giving up masseuse businesses because they couldn't stand the ill health effects they were experiencing from the vaxxed.
I'm having a break from it because things are changing and I'm getting sick.
Are these people feeling sick because it's like standing next to a small X-ray machine that's been permanently turned on? Other strange conditions like parosmia, a condition that distorts the sense of smell and taste, is also linked to radiation treatment and radioactive exposure. Another interesting thing about thulium-DM-170 is that it has been investigated for use in brachytherapy, which is a form of radiation therapy where a radioactive source is placed directly inside or near a tumor. But while it was effective in the short term, it was found to cause the development of secondary cancers. Could this be yet another example of cancer research being misappropriated for nefarious purposes? Another strange phenomenon is of people collapsing and then stretching out. This appears to be neurologically related. We see the same thing occurring during the live feeding of snakes. In fact, the herpetology community has a specific expression for it. Hashtag stretch gang.
Oh! What? Guys, you know what that is. That's that stretch time. Stretched it right out, guys. Oh my goodness, that was crazy. I haven't seen a stretch that good ever.
Many have asked what people are experiencing during these moments. A hospital emergency worker describes people collapsing and not remembering if they had time to dismount the bike first, or suddenly feeling like their eye was turning into their head and becoming severely lightheaded, or just can't see at all and becomes disoriented. The majority of nerve agents are organophosphates, mixtures of phosphorus, carbon, and other elements. The only known uses for them are as insecticides if weak enough, or neurotoxins if more potent. Confusion, tightness of chest, abnormal heart rate, higher low blood pressure, and constricted pupils are all symptoms. Finally, a person will begin convulsing and experience paralysis leading to respiratory failure. The final cause of death is asphyxiation as the lungs are paralyzed. So how do nerve agents work? Neurons in the brain are not physically connected to each other. The space between neurons is called the synaptic cleft. When the impulse reaches the end of the neuron, vesicles are triggered to release the neurotransmitter acetylcholine into the cleft between the two cells. Acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter responsible for transmitting nerve impulses across synapses, which ultimately causes muscles to contract. Acetylcholine binds to receptors on the sodium channels of the adjacent cell. This triggers the opening of the sodium channels. Sodium ions then enter the adjacent cell, depolarizing the membrane. This triggers a new impulse in the adjacent cell. Acetylcholine then attaches and is broken down by the enzyme called acetylcholinesterase. What nerve agents do is prevent the enzyme acetylcholine esterase from working properly. Neurotoxins bind to the esterase, preventing the breakdown of acetylcholine. When acetylcholine is not broken down, it continually triggers the reopening of the sodium channels. This allows constant flow of sodium ions into the cell, disrupting normal impulse transmission. The synapse has become flooded with a set of sodium ions, and the muscles never get the signal to relax. Notice in these cases the right upper arm of the victim is stretched out in maximum tension. The arm is bent by the biceps and brachialis, and straightened out by the triceps muscle. These muscles work in opposition to each other, with the biceps and brachialis contracting to bend the arm, and the triceps contracting to straighten it. Here, all three muscles are getting the signal to contract at the same time, creating opposing forces. All the muscles are pulling against each other. The triceps, the prime mover, is stronger, has greater leverage and hence wins out, resulting in the arm being straightened and staying locked in a flexed position, but at the cost of ripping the muscles and surrounding tissues, causing indescribable agony to the victim. Imagine every muscle contracting all over the body at the same time. The victim will jerk, twist, and convulse, but more fatally, the rib cage will expand, filling the lungs as they never receive the signal to relax. They die of suffocation due to being unable to breathe out. Slowest assassin in the world, the cone snail fires a tiny harpoon into its prey, which contains some of the most lethal mixes of toxins on the planet. These include conotoxins and tetrodotoxins, which is a potent type of neurotoxin that blocks sodium ion channels in nerve cells, leading to paralysis and death. The message for a muscle to move generated by the brain is transmitted using positive ions via axons in the many neurons along the path. As the ions move through the axons, their charge gradually weakens. To overcome this problem, there are voltage-gated sodium channels along the membrane that can allow positive ions or sodium ions to enter and maintain the strength of the impulse. When a weakened impulse reaches a channel, they are triggered to open, allowing positive ions to enter and subsequently increase the impulse strength back to its original condition. This allows the impulse to maintain strength until it reaches its intended destination. Well, that is how it should normally work. Tetrodotoxin is a potent sodium channel blocker that works by binding to the sodium channel protein and preventing it from closing properly. This leads to an uncontrolled influx of sodium ions into the cell, causing the membrane potential to become depolarized and preventing the normal propagation of nerve impulses. In simple terms, tetrodotoxin keeps the doors of the sodium channels open, causing the cell to become overly excited and preventing it from transmitting normal electrical signals. Tetrodotoxin can affect the heart and blood vessels, causing changes in heart rate and blood pressure that may result in cardiac arrest. It can restrict the muscles involved in breathing, leading to respiratory failure. It can affect the central nervous system, causing symptoms such as headache, dizziness, confusion, and seizures, and also cause a loss of sensation or numbness, especially in the face, tongue, and extremities. In short, cone snail toxins are some of the most potent and lethal substances known to man.
In the course of the investigation, CIA's laboratory storage facilities were searched, and about 11 grams, a little less than half an ounce, of shellfish toxin and 8 milligrams of cobra venom were discovered in a little-used vaulted storeroom in an agency building.
This is where I was in charge of finding documents that were that you don't find in libraries. One time they wanted me to find out if there was such a thing as a poison that was undetectable, especially one that seemed to mimic a heart attack, that would kill someone, but it would appear that they had a heart attack. I did find such a thing.
Does this pistol fire the dart?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chairman. And a special one was developed which potentially would be able to enter the target without perception.
The poison was frozen into some sort of dart, and then it was shot at very high speed into the person. So at, when it reached the person, it would melt inside them, and the only thing would be like one little tiny red dot on their body, which was hard to detect. There wouldn't be a needle left or anything like that in the person.
But also the toxin itself would not appear in the autopsy?
Yes, so that there was no way of perceiving that the target was hit.
In terms of its lethality, that quantity was sufficient to kill at least 14,000 people. If it were administered with the sophisticated equipment that was found in the laboratory, that quantity would be sufficient to kill a great many more. Estimates vary upwards into the hundreds of thousands.
The COVID story is an old one, planned a long, long time ago, back in the 1960s and early 70s. The toxins they are using in the vaccines, although synthesized and likely weaponized since then, date back that far. Even the nanocapsules, which sounds like very modern technology, were actually first developed by Werner Stober in 1968, the same year as the Club of Rome was founded. COVID and the vaccine as a depopulation agenda truly is the work of the mega-death intellectuals and the masters of that era.
World domination, same old dream. Our asylums are full of people who think they're Napoleon or God.